saw that there was some kind of troop movement from the Pakistani side. They have sent reinforcements to the Kashmir border.
Pakistan's relationship with India is worsened by a decision on Kashmir. This is Thursday, August 8th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Also ahead, after a day of relative peace, will Hong Kongers resume their massive protests? The new U.S. Defense Secretary goes where few high-ranking U.S. officials have gone before. And a massive car bomb explodes near a police compound in the capital of Kabul with fatal consequences. All on today's VOA Asia. Pakistan says it is expelling India's High Commissioner to Islamabad just hours after downgrading diplomatic and trade ties with New Delhi for stripping the disputed Kashmir region of its special status as bilateral relations continue to deteriorate. VOA's Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad. Ayaz, thanks for being with us. What is the latest? How far do you think Pakistan is willing to go, and how much will India take?
Well, we understand from the latest decisions that were taken today by Pakistan that they're going to, from tomorrow onward, Thursday onward, they will suspend the entire trade activity with India. And as of this moment, we heard from officials that Pakistan has also closed partially closed its airspace for commercial flights from India, because in a lot of Indian flights, they fly over Pakistan to European destinations, and that is quite a setback for the Indian commercial airliners. But these are the two steps that we know are now being put in place, in addition to expelling the Indian High Commissioner. But obviously, as we anticipated, like 10 or 15 minutes ago, as we speak, there have been reports of clashes, skirmishes across the disputed border in Kashmir between Indian and Pakistani military. So, you know, tensions remain high, and it is widely believed that they will deteriorate further.
How far can it go, however? Both India and Pakistan are nuclear-armed nations.
Well, that is really the dangerous aspect of this whole situation between India and Pakistan, because the worries that Pakistani leaders have expressed are that as of this moment, we know that there has been a massive security clampdown in Indian Kashmir. You know, in fact, since Monday, Indian authorities placed this security lockdown where there is no communication and, you know, no connection of Kashmiris with the rest of the world. Now, the worries are here in Pakistan that once the Indian government decides to lift those restrictions, there is definitely this danger of, you know, militants who are fighting Indian rule in Kashmir could retaliate with more power. And, you know, we may see some kind of major attacks against Indian forces. And that is when New Delhi will likely take some action, blaming Pakistan for supporting these militants. And we may see a repetition of what we saw in February, that there was a suicide bombing against an Indian paramilitary convoy that killed 40 Indian security personnel. And New Delhi quickly blamed Islamabad for orchestrating that attack. And then we saw that Indian aircraft, they crossed deep into Pakistan, and they hit targets on this side. And then within hours, Pakistan retaliated, and it shot down two Indian Air Force fighter planes. So that is the kind of situation we are in as of this moment, that if Kashmir, we know that it is calm, it is peace there, it's because there is curfew in Indian Kashmir, and it's because there is this clampdown, security lockdown, in fact. So things could really go bad once we see Indians start lifting these restrictions. That's what we're hearing from the officials in Pakistan, and that is why we saw that there was some kind of troop movement from the Pakistani side. They have sent reinforcements to the Kashmir border, anticipating that there may be some kind of an Indian action in the coming days.
Has there been any input or reaction from other nations beside India and Pakistan?
Well, yeah, what we saw, China immediately reacted to India's action, because India also, in order to stripping Kashmir of its special status, India has also divided the Jammu and Kashmir region into two portions. One is the predominantly Buddhist Ladakh region, which borders China, and China believes that it is its territory and that India is capturing its territory. So China came out with a very strong reaction yesterday, and the spokesperson at the Chinese Foreign Ministry condemned this move by India. But from other nations, we had not seen a serious reaction until this afternoon, local time, Wednesday, when we saw that the senior South Asian, senior U.S. State Department diplomat, Ellis Wells, who is currently in Pakistan on an official visit for 3-4 days, that she tweeted from Islamabad, rejecting reports in Indian media that Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India had taken into confidence the United States before removing this special status for Kashmir, undoing these constitutional provisions. So that clarification and rejection was quite significant, which means that we may see now more reaction from the Trump administration.
VOA's Ayaz Ghul talking to us from Islamabad. Ayaz, as always, thank you so much. These are among the top Asia stories. The Philippines Department of Health Tuesday declared that country's outbreak of dengue fever to be a national epidemic. President Trump says South Korea has agreed to substantially increase its share of the cost of U.S. troop presence in South Korea. Asian shares were mostly lower Wednesday as markets calmed after China's decision to stabilize its currency. Thailand's health ministry received its first batch of legal medical marijuana Wednesday to be distributed in state-run hospitals. And an official in Thailand has linked groups from that country's troubled south to small bombings last week in Bangkok as it hosted a meeting of the Southeast Asian foreign ministers. You're listening to VOA Asia. The Chinese official responsible for overseeing Hong Kong says the Asian financial hub is facing its most severe situation since Britain handed over control in 1997. At a conference Wednesday in Shenzhen, which borders Hong Kong, Zhang Zhouming, the head of the government's Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office, told hundreds of attendees the increasingly violent protests are having a wide impact on the Chinese territory's society. Everyday life in Hong Kong has come to a standstill, he said, after several weeks of massive street demonstrations that began in June with angry residents protesting an extradition bill that would have allowed people to be sent to mainland China for trial. The bill has since been suspended, but the demonstrations have continued and evolved into calls for greater democracy. Will those protests continue? That is what I asked Richard Bush, a senior fellow specializing in Asian affairs at the Washington-based Brookings Institution here in Washington.
I don't really predict a lull. I think that the sort of more radical elements of the opposition have a certain confidence that they have the government on the defensive. They're wearing the police down. They seem to have been able to sustain a lot of support among the common people.
If the protesters have the government on the defensive, what about Beijing, and what about Beijing's orders to Carrie Lam? Are you expecting them to go on the offensive?
Well, they certainly have gone on the propaganda offensive, including bogus charges that the United States is behind this. Second, I am quite confident that if Beijing decides to intervene with its own forces, it will not be the People's Liberation Army, because suppressing domestic disorder is no longer one of the PLA's missions for which it trains. This would be more likely the regular police or the People's Armed Police. It's not out of the question that there are Chinese policemen sort of slipping into Hong Kong to beef up the ranks of the Hong Kong police. But clearly, China would like this to come to an end. We're getting closer to the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, which is to be a huge panorama of all the successes of the Chinese Communist Party over the last 70 years. And for this to still be going on would be a great embarrassment.
What kind of effect is this having on the financial operations of Hong Kong?
That's not so clear to me. And one of the strange things about this whole episode is how quiet the business community at large has been, even though it has a lot to lose. If the Hong Kong economy should lose its reputation as a good place to do business, it may be that a lot of the financial operations that go on electronically and so aren't really disturbed by what's going on outside, as long as people can get to work. It's not clear that the protesters care one whit about business confidence in Hong Kong. In fact, they probably hope to deplete it as much as possible.
Wouldn't that be counterproductive to what they're going for? Doesn't Hong Kong need the financial strength that it has?
I suspect that the protesters would agree intellectually with that, but one of their major themes is that the Hong Kong economy and the Hong Kong polity are vastly unequal, that the benefits that flow to financial services organizations don't trickle down to the common people. So why should they care about those companies' interests? I am concerned about the signals that President Trump is sending out. He has expressed sort of a positive attitude to the way Xi Jinping is handling this, probably because he thinks that Xi Jinping would like to hear that. He has used the word riot to describe what has gone on there, and there's an argument in Hong Kong as to whether what we've seen is rioting or other lesser kinds of civil unrest. So the concern I have is that Beijing will take President Trump's approval or apparent approval as a blank check to go ahead and suppress this however they want to.
But you don't really think they're going to do that, I take it, from what you said earlier.
Well, I don't think they're going to use the People's Liberation Army, but there are other forces at their disposal.
Richard Bush at the Washington-based Brookings Think Tank. Happening now in Asia news, the U.S. is still hoping to hold another round of nuclear talks with North Korea, that despite that country's recent missile test, according to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Those talks could be held within a couple of weeks, he said, speaking shortly after returning from Asia and a failed effort to meet with officials from the isolated country. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper is in Mongolia as part of his first international tour since accepting the cabinet post last month. Mongolia is not a traditional destination of U.S. defense secretaries. Chuck Hagel was the last defense secretary to visit in 2014. So why did Esper go there? VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is in the Mongolian capital, Ulaanbaatar, with the defense secretary. Carla, what is it about Mongolia that made the cut for Esper's first trip?
The nation is in a neighborhood that has a lot of mischief. It's sandwiched between China and Russia. That is in part a major reason why senior defense officials here tell me Mongolia has had a pretty consistently upward trajectory of importance to the United States in recent years. It's also one of the reasons Esper told reporters traveling with him that he wanted to come here and build military relationships at a more senior level. Esper's focus as Secretary of Defense is on implementing the Pentagon's National Defense Strategy introduced in 2018. And that strategy prioritizes great power competition with, you guessed it, China and Russia. One of the key action items of this strategy is to cultivate more robust partnerships, and Esper called Mongolia among the key countries in the Indo-Pacific that the U.S. would like to bring more solidly over to its sphere of influence rather than China's sphere of influence. Mongolia refers to the United States as its third neighbor, and the U.S. is one of just a handful of countries to sign strategic partnerships with Ulaanbaatar. Mongolia is considered by U.S. defense officials to be a net exporter of security, and since Washington and Ulaanbaatar signed their first military-to-military agreement in the 1990s, Mongolians have been a major contributor to international peacekeeping missions and training. They have consistently participated in U.S.-led operations in Afghanistan with more than 200 Mongolian troops currently deployed to the war-torn nation, and they have provided U.S. service members with the opportunity for cold weather training, a useful skill in the event of any future confrontation with Russia or China. In fact, one defense official told me that the United States sees Mongolia as punching way above its weight. On the economic side, Mongolia would like to increase economic ties with the United States so it can potentially lessen its dependency on China. The vast majority of Mongolia's trade currently passes through China, and officials say Ulaanbaatar would like to find trade routes that don't involve Beijing. So while Mongolia is a stop out of the ordinary, it does make sense at this time for Secretary Esper, and he has said that he hopes to make future trips to countries such as Vietnam and Indonesia using this Mongolia stop as a model to connect with what he says are like-minded countries who believe in a free and open Indo-Pacific, who respect one another's sovereignty, so he can broaden those ties there. That compliment to Vietnam and Indonesia and Mongolia is clearly a dig at regional giant China. While touring the Asia-Pacific this week, Esper has repeatedly criticized China for, quote, destabilizing the Indo-Pacific through military aggression in the South China Sea, state-sponsored theft of intellectual property, and predatory economics.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. Coming up, the Taliban say they're responsible for a massive car bomb attack in Kabul. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. China said Tuesday that it will not stand idly by and will take countermeasures if the U.S. deploys intermediate-range missiles in the Asia-Pacific region, which Washington has said it plans to do within months. The statement came from the director of the Foreign Ministry's Arms Control Department. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features. VOA Asia continues. Afghan officials say a massive car bomb exploded near a police compound in the capital of Kabul Wednesday, killing at least 14 people and causing extensive damage to nearby buildings. The Taliban swiftly took responsibility for carrying out the attack against what it claimed was an Afghan police recruitment center in a western part of the capital. Local media reported at least 18 people were killed and more than 100 others wounded in the attack. The Afghan health ministry said mostly civilians, including women and children, were among more than 100 injured, taken to hospitals from the site of the attack. The deadly violence comes one day after the Taliban warned Afghans against participating in the upcoming presidential election. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news break now. President Donald Trump Wednesday said his tough stance on China's behavior in global markets would ultimately benefit the American economy, even as Beijing signaled it could strike back by curbing sales of critical chemicals known as rare earths. All the big stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. In a laboratory in California, engineers are working on pushing the boundaries of how robots move, imitating the way some animals jump, fly, or crawl. Michelle Quinn met Salto, a one-legged jumping robot, to see the future of robots.
This robot doesn't have a job or a purpose. Its name is Salto, and it jumps to help researchers work on how future robots can move.
Our thought is that the more we can understand about what enables the animals to work so well, and put those in our robots, we'll be on the right track to building better robots.
Robot researchers work to understand how animals move in specific ways and build robots that can fly, crawl, and jump.
Just having legs that move isn't enough to get a good bouncy robot. And so one of the key things is we call the springiness and the tuning of the springiness of the legs with the weight of the animal.
To make Salto, researchers studied how a Senegalese galago uses its feet, tendons, and leg in unison to jump high. It was packed with sensors and a computer and taught to feel its own self, its angle, the bend of its leg. Salto adjusts if it goes off kilter.
And so the new thing that we've done is we've enabled the robot to sense its own attitude or the angle relative to gravity and its position just using its onboard sensors and onboard computer.
Yim directs Salto where to go with just a joystick and radio controller. Salto does the rest. Fearing says his research is now looking into how squirrels move from tree to tree.
We think it's very fundamental that when a robot steps on something that it doesn't anticipate, how can it react? What are the limits of reaction? When can it recover? When does it fall down?
Salto is, of course, fun to watch, but it also might be a window into the future of robots. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Berkeley, California.
From robots to entertainment, China said Wednesday that it was banning Chinese movies and actors from participating in Taiwan's Golden Horse Awards, one of the Asian film industry's most prestigious honors, as Beijing ramps up economic and political pressure on the island it claims as its own territory. The one-sentence announcement on the microblog of China Film News, a newspaper affiliated with the government film regulator, gave no reason for the suspension, but it comes amid rising tensions over Taiwan's refusal to recognize being part of the Chinese territory to eventually be brought under Beijing's rule. Even without the ban, the Chinese artists might have found it difficult to make it to the November 23rd ceremony. Beijing recently issued a ban on solo travel to the island. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, and don't download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Nelson Lopes, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day ahead.